This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 12, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Senate continues debate on immigration reform as lawmakers in the House and Senate introduce bills to limit the NSA's broad surveillance program. At the Bradley Manning court-martial, prosecutors attempt to establish a timeline of what he leaked and how. And on the 50th anniversary of the murder of Medgar Evers, we'll go to Mississippi, where activists and organizers commemorate his legacy and the ongoing fight for racial and economic justice. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Dozens of Shiite Muslims in an eastern Syrian village have been killed in attacks by opposition fighters. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the attack Tuesday left civilians and pro-government fighters dead. The Syrian government says the victims were civilians. A government helicopter today fired missiles on the Lebanese town of Arsal, which is considered a safe haven for refugees and anti-government fighters. Al Jazeera calls it the first Syrian government attack on an urban area in Lebanon since the conflict began. The Lebanese army has threatened retaliation. Yesterday, rockets from within Syria hit a Hezbollah-controlled town in Lebanon. Hezbollah is an ally of the Syrian government, and although not confirmed, it's suspected that anti-government forces are responsible. Turkish riot police continued their assault on protesters in Taksim Square earlier today. Water cannons and volleys of tear gas rained down on thousands of defiant people who had gathered following yesterday's police crackdown. This comes as the prime minister met with a hand-picked group of celebrities to discuss the ongoing crisis. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
Clashes in Istanbul's Taksim Square that began early Tuesday raged into the early mornings of Wednesday as thousands of protesters refused to give ground to riot police who had retaken the square. Protesters, many of them young men and women who had covered their faces with goggles and paper masks to guard against tear gas, said they were dismayed that their gathering has been dismissed by the government as terrorism. This attitude, Turkish-American protester Yasmin Ersoy said, is polarizing society.
There's a huge separation of people who know what's going on, who don't know what's going on. People who don't know have their own set of news that are complete lies, and it's crazy, and they believe that. They're brainwashed by this. And they have no idea. They think people here are rioting and breaking buildings and being here for the hell of it. And they think the police are protecting us.
Today, EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton criticized the domestic media's lack of coverage of the protests and the government's attempts to restrict social media. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister's office released a statement saying it had met with an 11-member delegation of protester representatives. But the list included mostly celebrities, a soap opera star, several singers and artists, overshadowing the grassroots groups leading the demonstrations. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Wildfire in Colorado has forced the evacuation of a state prison. Officials moved more than 900 inmates at the Colorado Territorial Correctional Facility out of the way of the Black Forest Fire, which is burning nearly 8,000 acres, roughly 12 square miles. Officials say the inmates were moved because of smoke danger. The fire is burning north of Colorado Springs. The state of Texas says it will close a private prison in downtown Dallas that has been highly criticized by human rights activists. FSRN's Teddy Wilson reports.
The Dawson State Jail is owned and operated by Corrections Corporation of America. The facility has come under intense scrutiny after inadequate medical services allegedly led to the death of two inmates and a newborn child. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice announced the decision not to renew the Dawson contract on Tuesday. The Texas legislature voted to close the facility in March, but the Justice Department is charged with making the final decision. Dawson State Jail has been highly criticized for human rights violations by groups like Grassroots Leadership. Kimberly Kwong Charles is national organizer of its Public Safety and Justice campaign.
This is a victory that gives us tremendous hope and momentum. Texas is the birthplace of the modern private prison company, and if we can get the Texas legislature to agree that private facilities are not working for our state, that's good news for the national movement against for-profit prisons.
The $23 million contract for Dawson State Jail ends in August. Between now and then, more than 2,200 inmates will be transferred to other facilities. Another Corrections Corporation facility in the small town of Mineral Wells, west of Dallas, will also be closed at the end of the summer. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, Texas.
The Equal Opportunity Employment Commission says a BMW manufacturing facility in South Carolina and the discount retail chain Dollar General discriminated against minority employees through two broad criminal background check policies. The commission filed suit in both cases Tuesday. The EEOC says these kinds of blanket criminal background checks disproportionately affect African Americans and violate the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doran Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Senate continued debate today on the bill for comprehensive immigration reform after voting 84-15 to advance the legislation Tuesday. The bipartisan measure would funnel additional billions into border security, but also create a pathway to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants. Many immigrants and their supporters are expressing a concern about a Republican push for an amendment from Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley that calls for effective control of the southern border for 6 months before processing of immigration applications could begin. Critics say that would create unfair delays for the approximately 11 million people living in the shadows in the U.S. Many are also concerned about the bill's exclusion of binational LGBT couples, and an amendment has been introduced to allow citizens with a same-sex spouse to sponsor him or her for citizenship. Senator from Washington Patty Murray said these families are currently being split apart.
I was very proud of my home state of Washington when it voted last year for marriage equality. However, my heart breaks because each time a binational LGBT married Washingtonian is split apart because their marriage is not recognized by the federal government. It's just not right.
The immigration bill calls for $4.5 billion for border security, including expansion and border patrol agents. High-tech surveillance is also part of the plan, including making the controversial E-Verify program mandatory, implementing biometric entry and exit data collection at all land, air, and sea ports, and expanding the use of unmanned drones, which would track people who cross the border. A vote is expected in the coming weeks. As revelations continue to emerge about the U.S. government's broad surveillance powers, lawmakers in Washington are speaking out against Edward Snowden's decision to leak information about these capabilities to the media and are calling for his extradition. But several Congress members are questioning the government's right to collect the data in the first place and are refuting claims by President Obama that they were all fully informed about the NSA's activities. Bills introduced in the House and Senate this week aim to limit the scope of the spying, while a new lawsuit from the American Civil Liberties Union seeks to have the whole program ruled unconstitutional. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
National Security Agency Director Keith Alexander defended his department's recently exposed surveillance work during a Senate hearing Wednesday, where lawmakers asked him if the programs are necessary or constitutional.
They do this lawfully. They take compliance oversight, protecting civil liberties and privacy, and the security of this nation to their heart every day.
Despite recent claims from the White House that Congress members provide appropriate oversight of these programs, lawmakers tell FSRN that's not the case. Maine Republican Susan Collins, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said the mass seizures of telephone records and other data from U.S. citizens and foreign nationals was news to her.
The first that I heard of this program was when it broke in the news. It is not something that had been briefed to the committee as a whole yet. So before reaching conclusions about the program and how it should be run and who should be read into it, I need more information.
A closed briefing for all members of the Senate about these surveillance issues is scheduled for Thursday, with officials from the Justice Department, NSA, FBI, and Director of National Intelligence. But many lawmakers, including Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin, criticized the excessive veil of secrecy surrounding the intelligence gathering programs.
I mean, I think there's ways that we should be able to be much more transparent in the way that this power is exercised. I think the existence of the program is not necessarily something that needs to be classified. I don't think that compromises our national security.
Eight senators introduced a bill this week that would force the Attorney General to declassify rulings by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court on what types of surveillance are legal. Bill author and Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley told FSRN these classified rulings are the missing piece that will explain the gap between the law publicly on the books and how it appears to be applied.
If you look at the plain language of the law, which sets standards, there has to be an authorized investigation. The information sought has to be relevant to that authorized investigation. Those are standards.
Right.
And if you look at the bulk in data mining that's going on, it's hard to square.
Right.
What stands in the middle are the secret opinions of the FISA court.
The corporations that carry out the FISA court's orders are also calling for more transparency. Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Microsoft all wrote to the Justice Department this week asking for permission to publicly disclose how many FISA requests for personal user data they receive, how many they comply with, and what information is being sought. As these groups demand accountability from the executive and legislative branches, the American Civil Liberties Union is asking the judicial branch to strike down these broad surveillance powers as unconstitutional. ACLU attorney Patrick Toomey is working on the case.
Information that the government acquires through its mass phone tracking program is the same information that it would get by asking every American to sit down at the end of each day and turn over to the government a list of every person that was called, how long each call was, probably where each call took place. And so we think that the government can infer a huge amount about our lives using that information.
Activists will rally on Capitol Hill on Friday to call for a full congressional investigation into the government surveillance programs and to express support for Edward Snowden, the private contractor who leaked information about these secret programs to the media. In a story published Wednesday, Snowden told the local English-language newspaper South China Morning Post he is not in Hong Kong to hide from justice, but to reveal criminality. And he says he'll fight any efforts to extradite him. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, the prosecution in the court-martial for Army Private Bradley Manning questioned the computer forensics expert who analyzed much of the evidence against Manning. The testimony addressed Manning's communication while working as a military intelligence analyst based in Iraq. Manning leaked classified documents on U.S. military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, including a video showing U.S. killings of civilians and journalists and tens of thousands of U.S. diplomatic cables. The court-martial is in its second week in a military courtroom in Fort Meade, Maryland. For more, we're joined by journalist Kevin Gostola. He's covering the trial at Fort Meade and posting regular updates at firedoglake.com. Kevin, welcome back to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the prosecution's witness this morning, Mark Johnson, a computer forensic examiner who looked at emails and files on Bradley Manning's computer. Why did the prosecution call Johnson?
Well, he's there because he is the actual investigator. He put together all of these, you know, logs. He put together the different data that was able to be gleaned from going over Manning's MacBook computer, the personal computer he was using. And they are able to see what evidence they have of any possible submissions to WikiLeaks, of any deleting of files, the burning of files onto CD rewritable disks, on just anything that would have been going on in terms of receiving emails, perhaps chat logs. The government's been referencing alleged chats between an account that they believe was used by WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Julian Assange. It's the Press Association account. Although they haven't proven that he was actually the one using this account, it's their belief that he was using this account. And so that's why they put Johnson on the stand, was to get this entered into evidence and have his expertise be shared with the court on what he had found.
So if Johnson had access to that and he was the one who gathered a lot of that evidence, what's new that came from his testimony?
much of his testimony did come out previously. We already knew about it. However, you know, we're finding some more details about the timeline of events in terms of the disclosures. The defense was particularly trying to use Johnson to show that, as charged, the prosecutors say that this Guarani airstrike video, that was this horrible airstrike that resulted in a bunch of civilian casualties, I think well over 100 casualties, and they're trying to prove the defense that the transmission of it didn't occur back in November or earlier, and they're trying to change the date and get it to be April when they believe Manning would have provided the video.
Well, this timeline you're talking about does seem important to the prosecution's case. And just to take a moment, this video you're referring to is about an U.S. airstrikes that took place May 2009, Farah province in Afghanistan. As you mentioned, more than 100 civilians were killed, including children. As the prosecution is trying to establish this timeline, why is that important to the charges that they're trying to pin on Manning?
I'm not entirely sure myself. But what I do think it does is that it creates this conspiracy. And perhaps by creating this circumstantial evidence that there was a conspiracy, it makes it easier to argue some of the more severe charges. What they would like to be able to demonstrate is that Manning entered the military right away and began to provide information to WikiLeaks. So they're trying to make allegations that he was some kind of insider working on behalf of WikiLeaks. Well, the defense has come back with actual evidence through forensic reports that were put together that show these submissions, if they occurred, were happening in February, March, April. This is a few months into the deployment into Iraq, so it shows that he wasn't just immediately submitting information.
Kevin Gostola joining us from the court martial of Bradley Manning at Fort Meade. What's ahead for the rest of the week?
Well, what we know is that they're going to start to argue and discuss the ways that the systems inside of Iraq, the forward operating base Hammer in Baghdad. This was the base that Manning was at. They're going to go over the machines that he was using, how they worked, and possibly discuss some evidence relating to the system where he would have been viewing this secret government information that was disclosed to WikiLeaks. And after that, it looks like this could be another week where we don't go all 5 days. It does seem to be moving more quickly than expected.
Kevin Gostola is co-author of Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. He's covering the trial at Fort Meade and posting regular updates. You can find them at firedoglake.com. Kevin Gostola, thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Tonight in Louisiana, the public has a chance to attend one of the final hearings on the restoration plan for the Gulf Coast following BP's 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. It's part of the last round of federal public hearings across the five Gulf Coast states affected by the disaster. In Louisiana, a lack of funding has left many projects to restore the wetlands and barrier islands that help protect residents from storm surges dormant for years. FSRN's Caroline Lewis reports from New Orleans.
That's a garfish. It's called an alligator garfish.
65-year-old John Taylor grew up fishing and hunting in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, and now works with the nonprofit Center for Sustainable Engagement and Development. Taylor remembers what the wetlands around the Lower Ninth Ward looked like before the construction of the commercial shipping channel known as the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, or simply Mr. Go.
Before 65, there was trees and lilies and stuff like that, and saltwater intrusion killed all the cypress trees and all the vegetation. Now it's open water, and open water creates waves and bigger wakes that erode land and erodes the levee that protects us.
Mr. Go was closed after it contributed significantly to flooding during Hurricane Katrina. But much damage is already done. The shipping channel and other man-made levees have contributed to massive erosion of the Mississippi River Delta, about a football field every hour, even under normal conditions.
If we lose a football field of land continuously for another 20 years, where you're sitting now would be in water.
Extensive studies in Louisiana have shown that restoration techniques like sediment deposits would go a long way towards putting the Mississippi River and its ecosystems back on their natural course. A plan devised by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to restore more than 57,000 acres of land eroded by Mr. Go has been deemed a priority by the state and was included in Louisiana's 2012 Coastal Master Plan. But, like most of the projects in the Master Plan, the $3 billion endeavor cannot go forward due to a lack of funding. The Louisiana coast has long been home to the oil and shipping industries as much as fisheries and oyster beds. The Mississippi Delta was already one of the fastest disappearing land masses on Earth when BP spilled more than 2 million gallons of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network says he can't help but try to find a silver lining.
There's an opportunity in the fines and the funds that are going to be made available to ideally put that ecosystem on a trajectory towards sustainability.
BP has already begun to distribute the $20 billion it set aside for residents who claim economic losses due to the Deepwater Horizon spill. Viles says that the settlement process has overshadowed the opportunity BP funds offer to address more profound environmental problems facing the region.
There's no guarantee good things will come out of any of these processes. There's the opportunity, but it does require, I think, diligence and public engagement.
Separate from BP's settlements with individuals and businesses, the Restore Act will set up a trust with 80% of the Clear Air and Water Act fines owed by BP and other responsible parties. The money will be distributed among the Gulf states for projects that promote ecosystem sustainability and environmental stewardship, as well as economic stimulation and tourism opportunities. Critics of the act say there is no guarantee that the majority of the funds will go towards environmental restoration. Each state is able to submit projects for approval through the governor and one other appointee to the Gulf Restoration Council. In Louisiana, that's Garrett Graves of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. Mr. Graves did not respond to several requests for comment on which types of projects will be prioritized. But not everyone is holding their breath for BP's money. Taylor, who makes a daily trip to clean the shore of the Bayou Bienvenue in the Lower Ninth Ward, says he hopes Mr. Go will become a funding priority, but prefers to focus on the work at hand.
Even without money, we're still making small footsteps. We're not sitting around waiting for money. We're still doing what we have to do, but we just can't do it all without any help.
The Restore Act requires that a final version of the plan to distribute funds from the BP Trust be released by July 6th of this year. The full amount that BP will make available has not yet been determined. Caroline Lewis, FSRN, New Orleans.
Today marks the 50th anniversary of the murder of Medgar Evers, the civil rights leader who was gunned down in the driveway of his home by a white supremacist in Jackson, Mississippi in 1963. As the NAACP's first field officer in Mississippi, Evers led the vanguard for racial justice in the state. His house was firebombed and he received death threats regularly, but persisted in his work up to the night he was murdered. As activists and organizers commemorate his legacy in events throughout the country, those in Mississippi are taking the opportunity to reflect on how far that state has come and how far it has yet to go. FSRN's Anna Simonton has more.
During his time working for the NAACP, Medgar Evers was instrumental in a campaign to desegregate the University of Mississippi. He started a boycott of racist businesses, pushed for an investigation into the murder of Emmett Till, and organized voter registration campaigns. Martha Bergmark, president and founder of the Mississippi Center for Justice, says that Evers was a household name and that his death was a turning point for the civil rights movement in Mississippi. Bergmark was a teenager living in Jackson in 1963 and remembers the night Evers was murdered in his driveway, only a few miles from her family's home.
That was a very memorable night that prompted, I think, many of us in Mississippi, white as well as black, to ask ourselves the question about the growing civil rights movement, where do I stand, you know, and what am I willing to risk?
Bergmark went on to practice civil rights law, and on the 40th anniversary of Evers' murder in 2003, she cut the ribbon on the Mississippi Center for Justice, a legal aid organization that she envisioned as carrying on Evers' work. Bergmark says that in the decades since Evers' murder, she's witnessed the dismantling of what she calls legal apartheid. But, she says, racial and economic disparity continue to persist in Mississippi.
Our work as a nation to achieve racial and economic justice is far from done. The legacy of and history of slavery and Jim Crow didn't go away or be cured, you know, the minute the laws changed, as they did change in the 60s and 70s. We still have in Mississippi a dismal showing on almost every measure of human well-being.
Mississippi has the highest poverty rate of any state in the country, and the official unemployment rate is about 9%, compared to 7.5% nationwide. It ranks similarly in education, health care, housing, and food security. Bergmark says it's African American communities that are impacted the most by income inequality, predatory corporate practices, and insufficient public services. Mississippi's policies for distributing federal aid in the wake of Hurricane Katrina exemplify how the state disadvantages African Americans and other low-income communities. Along the coast, waterfront homes are mostly owned by wealthier white families. These houses were damaged by floodwaters during the storm. The neighborhoods just north of the water are primarily low-income African American communities. These properties were protected from flooding by a railroad bed that acted as a levee, but were severely damaged by wind. Mississippi developed programs for distributing federal aid, which stipulated that only people with homes damaged by the tidal surge would receive grants to rebuild, and refused grants to those with wind damage, which channeled funding disproportionately to the wealthier white population. The Mississippi Center for Justice took the issue to court and succeeded in redirecting about $130 million in federal aid to families who needed it most. Bergmark says as the organization embarks on its second decade of civil rights work, the anniversary of Evers' murder gives her and all Americans the chance to pose the same question she asked herself in 1963.
This opportunity to reflect on, yes, the tremendous and heroic life that he led, but at the same time pushing us again to say, what am I prepared to do now? And what am I prepared to risk to try to continue his fight?
A memorial service at Medgar Evers' gravesite in Arlington Cemetery last week was attended by members of the Evers family as well as political officials. On Wednesday, another service was held in Jackson, Mississippi, and other commemorative events are going on throughout the week. The anniversary comes as the U.S. Supreme Court is preparing to release opinions in two major civil rights cases, which could affect the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action policies. Anna Simonton, Free Speech Radio News.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Shauna Ray and Carla West. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.